I had always heard your entire life flashes in front of your eyes the second before you die. First of all, that 1 second isn't a second at all. It stretches on forever, like an ocean of time. For me, it was lying on my back at Boy Scout camp, watching falling stars. And yellow leaves from the maple trees that lined our street. Or my grandmother's hands and the way her skin seemed like paper. And the first time I saw my cousin Tony's brand new
Welcome, you're listening to the Crass Files podcast with Adam and Garth. It's Thursday the 8th of October 2015. You can get this podcast from Podomatic and also iTunes. You can also go to our website, which is crassfiles.com, YCRAZZ. Lots of podcasts going up there, lots of news links. Please check it out. And thanks for listening. Okay, Garth, we are plugged in for another week. Going to jump in the deep end tonight with our guest
all the way
from the UK. It's Anthony Peake, and I'm just going to bring Anthony in now because we got him for about an hour and followed Anthony's work for quite a while, and you as well, Garth, and we're just sort of trying to get our head around this, but Anthony's an incredible researcher and a great guy, and welcome, Anthony. Thanks for... joining us on Independent Media down in Oz.
Yeah, it's really great, and I'm looking forward to my visit down to Melbourne in January. My first visit to Australia, so I'm really looking forward to it.
You're coming down for a conference. Why don't we start off that, because I think our friend Barry Eaton will be talking at that conference as well, and you'll be down there, and I know you are looking, you're looking maybe to come to Sydney, I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, no, the plan is I'll be flying down the middle of the week before, and on the weekend of the 31st of January, I'm speaking at the Australian Afterlife Conference. What I'll be doing is I'll be doing an all-day workshop on the Friday, and then I'll be doing two 90-minute presentations on the Saturday and the Sunday. Now, the workshop will be the first time ever that I will have done a five-hour continual presentation on my work. And believe me, there is more than 5 hours of material there, because I'm going to take the audience through all my work from its very start to the logical starting point to where I am now at the process, because I'm just doing the finishing touches on my ninth book. And it's going to, I'm very, very excited about this. So it's going to be good. And then the plan is to then fly over to Sydney and do an event in Sydney, if that can be arranged as well, because myself and my wife would like to see Sydney while we're down under as well. So that's the plan.
Yeah, that'll be great. I'd love to go along and see you as well. And I guess we'll...
Where are you guys?
I'm in Sydney, and Garth's about 4 hours north of me. Mid-North Coast, so I do this from Sydney, and Gus up there via Skype. Mm. But, so much happening in Sydney, so if you can do that, that will be great, because I know it's gaining so much interest. But I love your talks. I've got two of your books that I'm trying to plunge through. As Gus was saying before we started, they're not really easy books. I mean, they're great books, but you can't rush through these books, especially your first one, Is There Life After Death? But I really am enjoying the Damon, because I heard you doing a lot of interviews and about that book, and it just struck me, you know, quite hard. So I'm just trying to get through that at the moment, and we'll talk about that as we go on a little bit. And also, I didn't know much about Philip K. Dick and a few of these authors, so I got 15 classic science fiction stories from him that I just want to have a look, because you were talking about him. So you're a pretty credible guy, Anthony, because you're taking so much interesting work, and it's no bullshit. It's all science and facts, and you're putting in your own theories, and you're presenting it to us, the public, in a really interesting way. And I enjoy your books, and I love your lectures, your talks as well, which you can get on YouTube, and the talks you did on Red Ice and all of that. They're really, really interesting. But why don't we wind back a little bit, because you are coming to Australia, and we have listeners all around Australia. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you sort of fell into this. Is this sort of research something that you were interested in when you were a boy? Is it something that you got into when you were in college? Because I guess the great thing about your work is it's just ever-changing, isn't it? There's so much happening all the time.
Yeah, well, effectively, I'm not a believer in anything, and I never have been. And what I am is a searcher for truth, which means that I've not come any particular viewpoint. Now, many of my fellow writers write books because they're trying to prove something. In other words, they have a belief and they go out and they search information out to support that belief. I've never done that. I have been interested in fringe phenomena since I was 8 or 9 years of age. I started back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, reading books, serial books such as Man, Myth and Magic and various other part works that came out in the UK, which introduced me to anthropology, introduced me to sociology, the sociology of religion, and the psychology and the way in which belief systems work. And I went to university, I went to Warwick University, where I did a degree in history and sociology. And in that particular degree, I focused very much on the sociology of language, the sociology of consciousness, and the sociology of religion. So I very much came from this viewpoint of exactly why we believe the things we do. I was also, when I was at university, I was involved in a parapsychology group, and we used to bop around the Warwickshire countryside trying to find poltergeist activity and cold spots and such like, but always from a very scientific point of view. I then did postgraduate at the London School of Economics in labor relations and labor law, and then started a career in human resources management. And over the years, I specialized in applications of psychology within work environments, and I'm a qualified psychometrician, which effectively means that I'm trained to interpret psychometric tests, psychological tests such as the 16PF and the OPQ and various other things, which I've applied in various businesses over the years. And in recent years, I've specialized in compensation and benefits analysis. So effectively, I do an awful lot of kind of statistical analysis and mathematical analysis for companies. But all through these years, I've always wanted to write a book, and it's always been my aim, because people who know me will probably reinforce this, and I think this will come across when I'm down in Australia. I have quite a peculiar mind, in that once I've read something and once I've taken it on board, it tends to be there forever. So in other words, I can recall it fairly instantaneously. So I'm a terrible person if you want to get into a debate with or into an argument with, because I do know my stuff. Now, what happened was around about 16, 17 years ago now, I did a business contract in Poland, or I was out assisting in some work out there, and I'd earned sufficient money to take some time out to write a book. Didn't know what I wanted to write about, didn't have a publishing deal or anything, so I was starting from nowhere. And my wife, in her infinite wisdom, said, right, take a year out. You know, we can live with that. Take a year out and do so. So literally on the first morning I was writing the book, I was sitting in front of a blank computer screen, looking out the window, thinking, what on earth am I going to write about now? I knew it was going to be something to do with parapsychology or whatever, but I didn't realize at the time it was my daemon guiding me. It was my daemon driving me, but I didn't realize that at the time. And I looked out the window, and as I was doing so, I started having a strange sensation. I started to feel tingling in my lips and tingling at the end of my fingers. And I realized, I'm a classic migrainer, so I realized what was taking place was that I was having the pre-migraine headache aura sensation. Now, I don't know if you know about this, but people that have classic migraine have auras before they have a migraine attack. Now, I'm one of the fortunate people is I just get the aura. I don't get the headache. Very rarely, and I haven't had for years. But it is quite a peculiar sensation because it's almost like you go into an altered state of consciousness. And while I was doing this, I had the most profound deja vu sensation that I had sat in front of that computer screen at some indeterminate place in my past, looking out of the window. I was living in Horsham in West Sussex at the time, looking out of the window. And I thought, wow, deja vu. That is a very, very peculiar thing. And when the aura went away, I decided that that's what I'd start writing about. I'd write a book trying to understand and explain the phenomenon of deja vu. And I started researching it, and I came across the work of a guy called Dr. Arthur Funkhauser, who is an American who lives in Switzerland, who's a Jungian analyst. And he's written a series of papers on deja vu. Now, Art, by background, by the way, is a quantum physicist. In fact, he's an expert. He did his PhD on light and lasers and holographic techniques. So he's a very interesting guy. But his take on deja vu was very interesting. Now, just as a step back, most of you will know what the deja vu sensation is. It's a sensation of recognition. When you go to a place, you might suddenly feel that you've been there before, that you recognize it. But it's normally something that's spontaneous. You can't make it happen. There's just suddenly this very, very strange feeling shakes through your body almost. It's like a bolt of electricity goes down your neck. And you go, woof, I've been here before. Now, Art argues that the reason you have these sensations is that you have recently had a dream. And you know, when we dream, we forget 90% of our dreams, but we remember them subliminally. And Art's argument is that what happens is we have a dream and we forget it, and it's precognitive. And then a few days later, a few weeks later, we then start living the precognition scenario and we recognize it. And we suddenly go, woo, I've done this before. Now, when I discussed this with Art, which I did as part of my research, Art said something and said, yes, no, that's probably what it is. And I said, but Art, the problem is that you're actually curing one problem with another, because effectively you're suggesting that deja vu is created by a precognitive dream. But science, as it stands at the moment, doesn't accept precognition. As such, it's something that is a fringe thing. You know, you're not supposed to be able to see the future because it hasn't happened yet. So I became intrigued on this, and I started. Then what happens, a very, very strange, and I'll talk about this in detail when I'm down in Melbourne, but it was quite weird. I get a phone call from a lady who was trying to see if I was interested in doing a short-term contract for a local company. And she phones up and she says, hi, Tony, because I go by Tony by my friends, by the way. Hi, Tony. I was just wondering if you were available for a contract. And I said, well, no, I can't, because I've decided to take a year out to write a book. So what then happened was the she went very quiet and she said, so what are you writing about? And I said, well, at the moment, I'm writing about déjà vu as a phenomenon. And I'm discovering some very interesting things, such as déjà vu is extremely common. 70% of people have at least one déjà vu sensation in their life. But it's more common with people that have migraine, which is why I had the migraine during my aura sensation. And it is also profoundly common with people who have something called temporal lobe epilepsy, which is epilepsy focused on the temporal lobes of the brain. And people with temporal lobe epilepsy have very, very powerful auras. The migraine aura is one thing. The temporal lobe aura is on a different level completely. And I might touch upon this later. But she turned around to me and she said, oh, we need to meet up. So I arranged to meet her in a hotel near Gatwick Airport. And we met up. And she sat down and she said, Tony, I couldn't speak in the office, but when you were talking to me, shivers were going down my spine because I've recently been diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy. And she said, everything you were describing, I experience. And I said, like, can you give me an example? And she said, oh, I can give you a hell of an example. And it was something that Garth and I were talking before we started about time perception. Because what happened was she was in a business. She'd visited one of her clients and she was in the canteen having a cup of coffee with her. As they were having a cup of coffee, her friend was having a cup of tea. And as her friend was about to pour the cup of tea, my associate suddenly felt a snap over her left ear. And her friend stopped moving. Completely stopped moving. And she thought she was pulling a leg. She thought, what's she playing at? And then she realized not only had she stopped moving, but everything around her had stopped. Everybody around her frozen. And there was this humming sound, low humming sound that she could hear. And then as she watched her friend, she realized her friend hadn't frozen. She was moving incredibly slowly. And she then realized the humming sound were people talking. But because her metabolic rate had been gone so fast, it was as if time had virtually stopped for her. And she watched for hours, she explained to me, as the tea came out of the spout of the teapot, fell down into the teapot and then into the cup and slowly filled up. She felt trapped in this. And she said to me, she said, I was there what felt like days, months. It could have been years. It could have been a lifetime. And then there's a snap over her ear again. And her friend continues pouring the tea, sits back and says, are you okay? As far as her friend was concerned, she'd just stared at her for a split second. In other words, she'd gone blank and stared. I now know this to be called a petit mal seizure. An absence seizure, okay? And it's part and parcel of temporal lobe epilepsy. She then was diagnosed because she thought she had a brain tumor, but she found that she had temporal lobe epilepsy. And I then said to her, well, what about the deja vu sensations? And she says, I have deja vu sensations where I know what's going to happen for the next 2 or 3 minutes. She said, I have the seizure, the aura starts, the deja vu starts, and I'm like, I've in a TV program or a movie I've already watched, and I watch the events around me happen, and I know what somebody's going to say to me. I know everything. Now, this intrigued me, and I started to look into it, and I found that in point of fact, this time slowing down sensation and falling out of time also happens in another phenomenon called the near-death experience. Because if you read the near-death experience literature, you will discover there's something called the falling out of time sensation. People feel that when they're in a car crash or when they're in an accident, time slows down. You know, and since I've written the first book, I've had hundreds of people contact me on this sensation. One guy contacted me and he said that when he was in a car accident on a motorway, his brain was traveling so fast and everything around him was so slow, he was able to drive the car around the cars in front of him to avoid accidents and drive his way through the traffic to get himself into safety. Now, in near-death experiences, this also happens. But there's something else that's reported in near-death experiences in what's called the Moody traits. There's a series of things that near-death experiences are gauged upon. Raymond Moody, who was the first guy that came up with the idea of the near-death experience, devise these traits to prove what a near-death experience is. And one of them is something called a panoramic life review. Have you heard this one? My life flashed before my eyes.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Now, I put these two together and I thought, hold on a minute. We've got two phenomena here that nobody's linking. There's the time dilation effect and there's the life flashing before your eyes. And I thought, this was what happens in a near-death experience. What happens in a real death experience? Could it be that your life doesn't flash before your eyes in a real death experience, but you literally live your life again in a three-dimensional recreation of your life? Now, if that was the case, I then explained déjà vu sensations. Because effectively, at the end of that life, during that life, the second life, there will be times when you will come across things you will remember from your previous life, and you'll go, been here before. Where have I been here before? It's because you've been before, because you've lived it before. And I then argue at the end of the second life, the same thing happens again and again and again in smaller bits of time, because inside your mind, time dilates infinitely. Okay? So you're in this kind of program, this matrix-like recreation of your life that you're existing within three dimensions. Now, the initial book, I very much just used that argument, and I did all the science behind it, and Garth, what you'll find, or you guys will find, this is where I end up with the book. However, over the years, this has become more precise. I now do the science of how this works. And I argue that you are living, you have multiple lives that you can live. In fact, every single outcome of every single decision that you make, that your associates make, that your parents made, that your grandparents made, all create an alternate universe, an alternate scenario. So effectively, there are billions and billions of lives that you can live using your life in your life. For argument's sake, let's argue that some of your listeners out there, their parents emigrated from the UK in the £10 passage in the 1950s. Like my parents could have done, because they were going to actually go to Tasmania. I could have been a Tassie, which would have been quite weird, really, from what I hear about Tassies. Nothing I'm objecting to Tassies, I could have been one. But the idea that my parents made that decision, and at the last minute, they chose not to go. If they had have chosen to go, they would have gone to Australia and I'd have been born in Tasmania and I'd have had a completely different life. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. My great-grandparents could have chosen to not do certain things. So in which case, my parents would have lived different lives. My parents may not have met. My mother may have met somebody completely different. My father may have met somebody different. All these alternatives are out there in what is called the zero-point field. Okay, the zero-point field is what myself and Irvin Laszlo, I wrote a book with Professor Irvin Laszlo, my last one. And in this one, we argue that there's something called the Akashic Record, the Akashic Field. And it's effectively a super-duper computer program. Have you ever played first-person computer games like, I don't know, Lara Croft? Okay, you play a first-person computer game. What happens? You switch the game on, bang, your little on-screen avatar, say Lara Croft, is just suddenly created. She's born. Now imagine from her point of view on the screen, if she was conscious, she's just born, she's there. She feels herself motivated to run down a corridor, which is, of course, the game player making her run down. She runs down the corridor. She thinks she's choosing everything, but she isn't. Okay. So she's running down a corridor. She meets a monster. Monster comes out and it kills her. The game ends and she goes back to the start of the game and the game player starts the game again. Okay? This time round, the game player knows there's going to be a monster around the corner. So the game player makes sure that Lara doesn't go down there by making her take a different path. Now, this is what I argue happens in your life. And this is where the daemon comes in. Okay? The daemon is your game player. The daemon is the part of you that remembers you've lived this life before, played this game before. So when you go down the corridor, or when you're the corridor which is life, the daemon remembers and says, oh, Garth came down here, or Adam went down here one day, And he got in this car, and there was a car crash, and he was killed. I'm going to make sure he doesn't get in the car. So what the daemon does is it tries to communicate with you in any way it can. It might give you precognitive dreams. It might give you warnings. It might give you deja vu sensations. It might even speak to you. And it stops you doing it. Now, if you've read my book, The Daemon, I give example after example after example from famous people like Rudyard Kipling to people like Winston Churchill to people who have written to me who have said when they read my books, they thought, wow, this is what happened to me that day. There's a guy I know who was a Rhodesian guy, a Zimbabwean guy, who was in the Rhodesian army in the 1960s. He was up in the north of the country in a place around called Mount Darwin, and he was riding on the top of a machine gun on an armoured vehicle. As they came round the corner, a voice in his head went, ambush, 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 duck, duck, now. He didn't. And suddenly he was pushed, physically something pushed him out of the seat into the camouflage webbing where he trapped and he actually broke his finger as he fell. And as he did so, a machine gun ripped into the seat. It would have killed him. That voice was the voice of his daemon, the part of him that had lived the life before. And what happened was the daemon was sitting there minding its own business in his brain and suddenly recognizes and goes, whoa, he's going to come round this corner. He was killed last time. I've got to do something about this. So it tries to communicate with him, and he didn't listen. So it literally physically pushed him out of the thing into the netting and saved his life. Now, going back to the computer analogy, it means we live our lives over and over again. And every decision we make in our lives, every decision either we make as what I call the Eidolon, which is the person that's living time in the game, makes decisions, and the daemon makes decisions. Every time you make a decision, you effectively flick into another universe. You change the game, just like you do when in your computer game, Lara Croft gets killed and you start again. The minute you take Lara Croft in another room within the game, that game is rendered, isn't it? That room is rendered. It's what, you know, Tom Campbell argues about the fact that everything is in a computer program, and when you look at it, it's rendered. When you look away from it, it is unrendered. Okay? And this is exactly what my argument is, that you are in a matrix-like recreation of your life, and eventually, after many, many games through your life, and I call this place you exist within the Bohmian IMAX, and if we get time, I'll explain what this is, you eventually live the perfect life. You live the perfect game. And then you're allowed to move on. And remember, all of this has happened in the split second before you die. You could be there for 10,000 years playing the game. It's what the Buddhists call the bardo state. It's known within mystical traditions. It's been known for years, as is the daemon. Most mystical traditions will talk about the higher self, the guardian angel. Various traditions around the world call it different things. And in the book, The Daemon, I describe all these. It's a known fact. Now, the whole thing about this computer program has put the universe being a computer program. Recent research is actually proving that we are existing inside a hologram. Hmm. And I know there's going to be people out there going, oh, God, he's talking nonsense. This is not science. Tell that to Stephen Hawking. It's to do with something called Hawking radiation. And Hawking radiation is evidence of the fact that this is a hologram. I can't go into detail now, but there's a guy called Dr. Lee Smolin in America that's doing research on it. There was the front cover of Scientific American 5 years ago actually said, we are living in a hologram. We are living in a hologram. It actually, the front cover said, we're existing inside a hologram. There is certain clues in cosmology to this case. Now, on top of this, we have something called the Many Worlds Interpretation of Particle Physics by Hugh Everett III, who in 1957, in his PhD thesis, suggested that we are one of trillions and trillions of universes, all of which some are subtly different, some are greatly different. And the reason he brought this forward was to explain some of the more bizarre effects of quantum physics. So again, nothing I'm talking about here is not scientific. I initially argued that the daemon exists in the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain. My latest book will be suggesting that the daemon, your higher self, exists in what's called your astroglial network in the brain. Do you know, if you hear the tale, people turn around and say that you only use 10% of your brain. Do you know where that comes from? Do you know where that came from?
No.
Okay. In your brain, there are brain cells called neurons, okay? And neurons communicate with each other using neurochemicals called neurotransmitters, which send signals, electrical signals, across the brain. For years, people have believed that the neurons are where consciousness is, and the neurons are everything that there is. But the neurons only make up 10% of the brain. 90% of the brain are made of sort of cells called glial cells. Glial is German for glue. They believed that the only thing that these cells did was a glue to hold the neurons in place. Now, nature is very parsimonious. Nature doesn't do things for no reason. To have 90% of your brain doing nothing is utterly ridiculous. It wouldn't have evolved that way. Recent research has shown that the glial cells, particularly something called astrocytes, communicate with each other. And they communicate using waves of ions, particular subatomic particles. And these go across the brain in waves. And I believe that this suggests that there are two personalities in your head. There's the eidolon, which is you and I and most people that are listening to this, whose brains, you're in your neuron brain, where the neurons communicate. But the daemon, your higher self, uses the rest of the brain, the 90% of the brain, and that is the daemon. And the daemon knows much, much more, and the daemon perceives reality in a completely different way, because the astroglial network communicates in a different way. It communicates using subatomic, it uses quantum physics. It actually uses non-locality. There's one major problem of neurology these days. It's called the binding problem. It's how everything comes together in one pace in the brain. For instance, we are now you're listening to me talking, and you've got various other stimuli coming in. Everything seems to you simultaneous, doesn't it? You know, the feeling of sitting on your seat and the sounds around you and everything else. But they come in different speeds into the brain. So it should be that we should have a perception of reality that breaks up. It doesn't. It's bound together. The binding problem. The astroglial hypothesis explains this, because the brain works non-locally. It works, again, holographically. So again, if reality is a hologram and the brain is a hologram, we've got something very interesting happening here. Sorry, it was a bit of a long monologue, but that effectively is the background to a lot of my work, why I did it and why I wrote it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Anthony, just on that, on the brain side, I remember you were talking about how the brain receives the reality in sort of like a movie picture, say a 12th of a second. You get a plate at the back of the brain, and you were describing that if you see reality in a slower version of that, you know, it might only be the plates at the back of your brain received were slower, you would then receive reality in a different way. Can you explain that for the
listeners? Indeed. It's called the critical fusion facility. And what it is effectively is it works in a similar way to the way a cine film works. In other words, if you look at a cine film, what is happening is there is a series of still images that are all slightly different, flicking past at speed. And what it does is it gives the illusion of movement. It's the same thing, you know, when you take a magazine and you put a little stick figure on the pages and you flick through as you did when you were kids, like a cartoon works. And this is how vision works. So what happens is there's a series of static images that are processed on the retina at the back of the eye, which is then sent to the visual cortex at the back of the head. Now, the critical fusion facility of the human eye is, I'm not sure, I think it's about 16 images per second, something like that. But there's no reason why that should be 16 images per second. It could be one image an hour. And in fact, if you look at time-lapse photography of plants growing and things which you see on nature programs, that's what they do. They literally take one image every minute and you see what could be a day's growth of a plant in 10 seconds. Now, if you had the critical fusion facility of 1 year, and you were a creature that did that, and you were existing, say, looking down on the Earth wouldn't look like a sphere going round the sun, would it? It would actually be a torus. It would be like a hula hoop going round the sun. And the sun in turn would be a kind of a spiral spring, because, of course, the sun is moving through the heavens towards Alpha Centauri, I think. And, of course, what you would then have is, on the surface of the Earth, along this torus, along this thick hula hoop, to a size of around about 10 foot, there would just be this mass of protoplasm, which is life. Now, the reason I say this is, if you set up a camera in a shopping centre, and what you did with the camera was, instead of having the camera working like the human eye, taking one image every 16th of a second, you had the camera taking an image every 2 hours, the people walking through would not be individual people. They would be like a snake, wouldn't they? Because you'd get the image of the movement, and other people would walk in the other direction, would walk across them, and would meld with them, as would everything else. Now, there is no reason why that perception is the right perception or the wrong perception. Rather, like, our perception is not the right or the wrong one. I use this analogy. I call the way we think what we see being absolutely as it is. There's a technical term. It's called naive realism, which is the term that the scientists use. But I call it something different. I call it electromagnetic chauvinism. The reason I use this is we believe that everything we can see is as is. And the only reason that is that our eyes are trained and designed to be stimulated by what we call visual light. And all visual light is the visual part of the electromagnetic spectrum that our eyes react to. There is no such thing as red out there. There's no such thing as blue. There's no such thing as green. Everything is black. There isn't color. The only thing we see as color is that electromagnetic waves bounce off something, and depending on what part of the electromagnetic spectrum is bounced back, will depend on what color we see. And we perceive the green section of the electromagnetic spectrum as this color green. But you try and explain green to somebody else. You can't, because green is what's called a qualia. It's a sensation. It doesn't exist in reality. Now, so we think everything that's out there that we see is real, and that's part of it. The electromagnetic spectrum, if you take it from one extreme to the other, from, you know, sort of radio waves through to X-rays and gamma rays on the other side, imagine that that length was the same as the Mississippi River. Okay, so the electromagnetic spectrum, the length of is like the Mississippi River, starting in a little lake up in Minnesota, going down to the Gulf of Mexico. I don't know how many thousand miles it is. I think it's about 6,000 miles. I'm not sure how many it is. But the visible spectrum that we think is everything would be 1.5 inches about 12 miles south of Hannibal, Missouri. That's what we think is reality. That's electromagnetic chauvinism. We think that other animals see the world in the same way as we do. A bee does not see light in the way we do. A bat doesn't see. It sees through sound. A bat creates a worldview based upon sound. There was a very famous philosophical paper written many, many years ago called What It Is to Be a Bat, and whether we can ever think into the mind of creatures whose facilities and sensual capacity is completely different to our own. And this is how my argument is that we need to broaden the way we see things. You know, we argue that when, you know, telepathy, for instance, is impossible. Well, telepathy is only impossible because our present scientific paradigm says it's impossible. I know of a lady that has been working, Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell, who's been working with a young girl in the States called Haley, who is a very, very enclosed autistic child. This child is telepathic. Proven, absolute, no doubt, this child is telepathic. They have proven it time and time and time again. The question is, we now have somebody who's telepathic. Instead of ignoring it, let's try and do the science to find out how telepathy can work. How can one brain communicate with another at a distance? These are things that are profoundly important. And if our science refuses to look at the evidence, just the evidence as it is, that telepathy takes place, that precognition takes place, these things do happen. They happen to 90% of the population. When I do talks, when people start feeling relaxed, they start citing examples of things that have happened in their lives, you know, including sort of scientists. You know, one scientist once said to me, you know, he said, don't believe of anything you write, you know, it's all nonsense and everything else. However, once I had this really strange precognition. And I said, so didn't that make you question? Oh, no, 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 it was chance, it was coincidence. And as long as people are doing that, we're never going to get any further with our science. Exactly. There are big problems with our science at the moment. There are things that don't make sense. Lots of things that don't make sense. The placebo effect doesn't make sense. Dark matter. What is dark matter? You know, 94% of the universe is missing. We don't know what it is. You know, these kind of things. Dark energy. It's synonymous and similar to what was happening in the 1880s and 1890s in the world. Science thought they had all the answers. The Victorians were so full of themselves, hubristically full of themselves, in the sense they thought one guy turned around and said that I think all we need to discover now is something to a few more dots of percentage points and we'll know everything. There were two or three things they couldn't explain, things like the electromagnetic catastrophe, black body radiation, things like this. The electromagnetic, the way in which sort of light kicked electrons out of when you shined light on things. These things they couldn't explain. Max Planck in 1900 came along and came up with this crazy idea, absolutely crazy mad idea, because he couldn't make the maths work. So he thought, if energy is not continuous and comes in little packets, which he called quanta, the maths works. And suddenly he was able to explain so many of the anomalies the scientists couldn't explain. Then on comes Einstein. Up until then, everybody argued light was a wave. Light had to be a wave. It's a wave function. It moves like a wave. Einstein said, but you can't explain the photoelectric effect if light is a wave. They've got to be tiny particles. And suddenly the photoelectric effect was explained. And suddenly light became a wave and a particle at the same time. And suddenly we had quantum theory. Suddenly we had quantum mechanics. And from quantum mechanics is the reason that we're now being able to talk now, because the internet and everything else works on quantum mechanic principles. And this is because we started thinking differently. And I think we're now at this point, and the issue is consciousness. What is consciousness? One of your fellow Australian philosophers came up with the idea, a guy called David Chalmers, came up with something called the hard problem of science. The soft problem is how the brain works. The hard problem is how inanimate matter and gloop and electrical charges in your head, in your brain, creates Gareth and Adam. Your hopes, your fears, your dreams, everything about you is created by, in the final analysis, inanimate matter, isn't it? How can that be? How does consciousness come about? Is there a point where all this inanimate matter comes together and 1 minute, just the addition of one more electron suddenly creates you? Is there a point where consciousness just suddenly gets downloaded into the brain, just suddenly happens? Or is there more to it? And these are the things that shake my tree.
That's the thing, Anthony, with the brain. I've heard you say that it's this, our brain is this meat encased in our skull. You know, we're skin and bone, but how is all this able to take place? The daemon and our consciousness, does it reside somewhere else? I mean, where does the daemon reside? I guess it's sort of like a passenger through our lives that's there with us or around us. Where have you been able to work out that it may be exactly? Is this all outside of us? Are we channeling this, is what I mean?
Yeah. Effectively, in my latest book, the one written with Irvin Laszlo, called The Immortal Mind. We put together the science of consciousness being a field. So in other words, there's a field of consciousness. The brain is a receiver
makes sense, of consciousness. That makes sense to me immediately.
In other words, for instance, taking apart the brain to find consciousness is like taking a motorbike apart to find speed. Okay, you're looking for something completely different. It's like taking a radio apart to find the studio. It's like me taking my computer apart now to find Adam and Garth in the computer. And of course, you're not there. You're in Australia. Yes. But if I was naive, looking at the information I'm getting now, I can see your images on the screen. I'm hearing your voices coming through my speakers. You have to be somewhere in my computer. And this is the category error. This is the mistake we make with consciousness. We assume because we look at the world through our eyes that we're in our head. If our eyes were on our knee, we'd think we were in our knee. It's because all our sense organs are up here. The brain literally is something that receives information from a consciousness field. It's been proven. It's been proven in the sense of research that has been done over recent years. For instance, there is a worm called a planaria. Planaria are very, very small worm creatures. And what's strange about planaria is you can cut their heads off and they'll just regrow a new head and a new brain and everything else. They've been able to train planaria to do certain things against their nature. They have a fear of light, but they've been able to override that fear of light and train a planaria to do that. And they then cut the planaria's head off, okay? Which means its brain has gone. The new head grows back with a brand new brain, and guess what? That planaria has the same learning patterns as the one that had the chopped off head. Which proves, I know we're talking about planaria, which are very basic animals, but they still have neurotransmitters in the brain, they still have neurons in the brain, they still have glial cells. So this proves, without any question of a doubt, that whenever we think that the brain is the creator of intelligence and the creator of consciousness, it's an epiphenomenon of brain behaviors, it's nonsense. The evidence is crying out loud. That's not where consciousness is. And if consciousness is not in the brain, then the question is, when we die, it doesn't matter. That your brain dies is of no consequence. It just means that your radio isn't working. And this is what I'm arguing with Alzheimer's disease at the moment. Alzheimer's basically is the signal can't get through. It's getting garbled. When people go into comas, they're not there anymore, you know, or they can't get through. But they are still there. And of course, the immortal you is your daemon. The you that exists in the field, the life field, is you. Indeed, I would go further to say that not only that, but the field is unitary. Every single consciousness is an embodied consciousness of a single consciousness. We are a collective consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. This is what Bill Hicks, the American comedian, said in one of his monologues. And I think it's such a powerful argument. The idea is that we are in a single consciousness embodied in our own soap opera. In other words, we are existing, perceiving and learning within this computer program in order to advance, to get to know ourselves better, to learn more about the universe and everything else. And this is getting less and less crazy New Age waffle crap. And it's actually based on science. And this is why I alienate a lot of people. What happens is the woo-woo crowd who want to believe any nonsense, and they have such open minds, they'll have their open minds to the extent when their brain falls out, who will believe any nonsense. And if somebody says, I'm channeling nonsense from the planet Tharg, and I'm talking to a 6,000-year-old Atlantean warrior, they eat it up, and they pay lots of money to these people. These are charlatans, and they're dangerous because they actually cause problems because the hard scientists look at the charlatans and tar us all with the same brush and say, oh, Anthony Peake and Tom Campbell, they're all part of those loonies. So the rest of the population think we're loonies as well, but we're not. We're doing the science, and we're taking the science to the scientists. But the scientists don't like what we're doing either, so they ignore us. In other words, for instance, no article on me on Wikipedia because it was pulled. And the reason it was pulled is because what I'm doing is not the same as what the Sky Pilots are doing. You can criticize the Sky Pilots. Criticizing Anthony Peake is a lot more difficult I was at a debate in London 18 months ago, where I had a debate with the editor of Skeptic magazine, one of Britain's top skeptical philosophers, and a neuroscientist. And there was myself, Graham Nichols, and another research scientist on the other side. And to be frank, from what the audience said, we took them apart. Mm. Because they were expecting us to be talking, oh, you know, the Atlantean warrior in my head is telling me this, and I talk to dead people and I do all these weird things. And what we were doing, we were actually pointing things like the planaria experiment. And suddenly it was, oh, I've not heard about that. Because they hadn't. Because they hadn't done their research, you know.
Shallow. There's shallow into it. That's why we do this, because the media in Australia, quite frankly, is just, it's unbearable. You know, and that's why it's just good. We've got the technology. It's great. We can speak with great people mm-hmm. like you and go through ourselves and get it out there ourselves, because these people, they're just shallow and they'll backstab you behind your back. But then when you bring up the information, oh, I didn't know that, or you know, they'll run and hide under the nearest rock.
They do. If you want them panicking, just point. Just say. Say wave particle duality, explain that to me, and you'll suddenly have them panicking. Explain to me dark matter, explain to me the placebo effect. You know, all these things are things that they have no answers for. But what they do is they give them labels. This is the game they play. They give something a label. It's like hallucinations. Hallucinations they can't explain, so they call them hallucinations. And hallucinations aren't real. So an hallucination, by definition, is something that I perceive that's not in the external world, that other people don't perceive, okay? So if you and I share an hallucination, we see a UFO, we see a ghost or something else, that's what's called a folie à deux, which means two people are hallucinating. If a lot of us see a UFO or a ghost or something anomalous, then it's collective hysteria. But none of them have actually explained how you and I, when we have a folie à deux, have shared the same perception. That means telepathy. Oh, but telepathy doesn't exist, does it? So how do you explain? You explain one thing by explaining it with another thing, or just saying, well, it's an hallucination. Give it a trendy, doctoring sounding name. Give it a nice Latin name or a Greek name. And the masses will think you've solved it. They haven't. They're pretending. They're skating on thin ice. They're trying to nail jellyfish onto a wall. And sooner or later, it's going to be out there. They're treading water here. For instance, a few years ago, there was a terrible series of events in the UK. If you heard about it, a guy called Brian Josephson. Brian Josephson is the, as far as I know, the only living British Nobel Prize winner for physics. They had a series of stamps that were going to go out in the UK showing Nobel Prize winners from Britain. There was a massive objection to Brian Josephson being on the stamp, even though he's a Nobel Prize winner for physics. And you know why? Because he does research into telepathy. And I don't think he appeared on the stamps in the end. Now, that is exactly why this is wrong. This is like the Inquisition. You're not allowed to think these things anymore. And you're accused of being a woo-woo merchant. You're accused of being a pseudoscientist. I would defy anybody out there to pick holes in my science. Pick holes in my conclusions, but don't pick holes in my science. Because effectively, every single article I write, every single reference I make in my books goes back to academic papers. If you look at the back of ITLAD, There's the Life After Death, you will find page after page after page of reference material. I ask my readers to go back and look at the support material and make up their own minds. I'm not trying to convince them of anything. I'm trying to open their minds to appreciate that the universe is far more fascinating than we can ever begin to believe. And we are just taking the first faltering steps on a real understanding of a new paradigm of science.
It certainly is a fascinating first step, isn't it? It's so unbelievable when you look at some of the things that are coming out that you're talking about, Anthony, which is absolutely amazing. Like one thing I can remember, you were talking about, say, a hand movement, for example, and how the brain can actually decide some up to about 8 seconds before you make some, be it a hand movement or another thing, a physical movement in your body, that your actual brain is way ahead of it.
That's right. It's called the intention to flex. And it was originally based upon a series of experiments done by somebody called Benjamin Libet, or Benjamin Libet. I'm never quite sure how you pronounce it. The overall idea is that they actually discovered that when you think you are about to make a movement, your brain has already decided to do it. So in which case you're actually trailing behind what your brain is doing. But it's even weirder than that, because there's did you come across the PHI experiment, PHI? This is where you can, there's a series of lights, and what it's quite interesting. It's if you have a series of lights, say 10 lights in a line, and the first five are red, and then in the middle they turn to green, okay? And they go backwards and forwards in a kind of a flowing situation. Now, that's right, no. They start as red, and then nine of them, for instance, nine of the bulbs are red, and then the last one is green. And the lights switch on, and they move across very, very quickly. Without exception, the first time it goes on, all human beings see the lights change to green in the middle before they even know the colour of the final light. It's called PHI experiment. There's some material on it on the web. This suggests either that we are there's only two answers to this PHI experiment. Either we're precognitive, because we know in advance what's going to happen,
yeah,
or the brain buffers information before it presents it to consciousness. And I believe this is what's actually happening. Your brain will hold back, as it does with the gestures and the movements, until it's got more information. This explains the car slamming effect in a car park. If you're in a car park and somebody slams a door in a car door in a car park, there is a certain point where the slamming of the door is simultaneous with you seeing the person slamming the door shut. But after a certain point, there's a delay whereby the door is slammed shut, and of course, because sound takes longer to get to you than light does. So there's a delay. But it's a particular point. It's not gradual. There's a point where the brain suddenly says, right, I'm not doing it simultaneously anymore. These are things that are incredibly intriguing about how the brain processes reality. There's another experiment, again, which the listeners want to check out. There's three. There's the Libet experiment, something called the cutaneous rabbit experiment, and the PHI experiment, PHI. Again, don't take my word for this. One of the world's leading materialist reductionist philosophers, Daniel Dennett, discusses this in his book Consciousness Explained, and he's trying to play it to prove it from the other direction. But I've taken these things and said, hey, just a minute, this actually proves something a good deal more weird. But literally, again, on this, Garth, you might be interested, if you go onto YouTube and put in Marcus de Satoy, Sautoy, okay. Marcus de Satoy is a British mathematician, and he visited somebody called, I think it's Darren Haynes, something like that, who is a researcher in Germany. And this delay of perception of how we move, the delay to move, this is where we get the 6 seconds from. It was in a British TV program called Horizon. And you see at the end of the program, you see Marcus de Satoy sitting there when he'd actually been shown on the screen the 6 second delay. He said, I cannot believe what I just saw. I cannot even begin to believe what I just saw. These are the things that are out there. These are the things that science are discovering. These are the things that really the world should know about.
Yes, I certainly agree. And it is so fascinating talking and getting your knowledge on this, because as Adam mentioned, you're not going to get it in the mainstream media. And they don't teach kids at school this, which is a dreadful shame. This is exciting stuff for young children who could get their minds around a lot of this. And what a great start.
Well, they could, exactly, because I think, you know, there's a term I use in my writing all the time. It's called Zeitgeist or Weltgeist, and the idea that the time is right for these ideas. And the time is right for these ideas now because youngsters live within the digital age. They can appreciate the subtlety of when I say that you are living within a computer program. They get it. They do it because they play in three-dimensional computer games. They know what virtual reality is. So they're going to get it. Mm. And they're going to understand it. And they're going to take it that step further. Again, there's a guy called Vlatko Vedrell, who's professor of physics at the University of Singapore. He's recently written a fascinating book on evidence that the whole of the universe is information, that the basic of everything is information. And everything we perceive, everything we sense is all information. It's all digital. Now, again, this is not the nutty guy down the pub over a few beers. This is probably the most interesting and most powerful young quantum physicist on the planet.
Mm. That's
amazing.
It is amazing, isn't it? It's taken, like, I'm not a young person. I'm getting on, Anthony, and I'd have learnt this, you know, 20, 30 years ago. That would have been.
How old are you, Garth?
Well, I'm 78.
Wow.
He's a freak, isn't he, Anthony?
Wow, congratulations. To be interested in this kind of stuff, that is, I am amazed and impressed. Incredibly so.
Thank you. Well, I've always been interested in it, but until people like you come along, what I'm saying here is that you lead people like myself, and there are many of us who are interested in it, but because we've never been educated at the higher level to be able to get this knowledge, a friend of mine went through university, or a number of friends of mine earlier, and I remember asking one of them, I said, well, what do you actually gain out of that? And David was a close friend of mine. He said, it's access to knowledge. He said, that's basically all that I've learned. And I played with that for a while, and I thought about that, and I thought, well, he's probably right, because it is difficult knowing where to look for it.
Yeah, it is indeed. You know, if we don't, we are educated in particular channels of thought. You know, because effectively, as a sociologist, you know, I know how education works, and I know that it's programming. Now, I don't necessarily. I'm in no shape or form a conspiracy theorist. I'm not. I don't do conspiracy theories. I believe in the cock-up rule of history. I think our fellow human beings are just as incompetent as we are, and our leaders are as competent as we are. Nothing more, nothing less. But effectively, we are taught to think in certain ways. And of course, the history we are taught is based upon the history of victors. It is based upon the history that we need to know as children. The same goes for the science we are taught. You know, there is a lot of deliberate obfuscation of science. I mean, my wife did physics at A level over here in the UK, and she wasn't taught anything really important about quantum physics. You know, she wasn't taught about wave particle duality. She wasn't talked about superposition. She wasn't talked about a lot of the really interesting areas that are really now at the leading edge of science. You know, quantum computing. You know, quantum computing is the big thing of the moment, but 99.9999% of humanity is not aware of it. I'll guarantee that if I mention to the audience now one of the most important experiments that has ever taken place, took place at the Institute of Optics at the University of Paris in 1981 and was done by a guy called Alain Aspect or Alain Aspar, I will guarantee that most people will have never have heard of that. And this was the most important experiment because it proved something called non-locality. It proved something called Bell's inequality. Now, I won't go into details about this, but what this did prove was that if you take two subatomic particles and you place them in the same system, for want of a better term, and then you send one of the subatomic particles to the other side of the universe, and you leave the other one on Earth. If you do one thing to the one on Earth, the other one reacts instantaneously. Instantaneously. It's called spooky action at a distance. Einstein tried with the thought experiment with two associates, Poldonsky and Rosen, in about 1937, I think, he wrote a paper which became the EPR paradox. John Bell did the maths of this to prove that Einstein's thought experiment, which was trying to disprove non-locality, was actually wrong. And that Einstein was proven wrong. And then Alain Aspect, in 1981 in Paris, reproduced it in an experimental form and proved it. And since then, there's a guy called Anton Zeilinger at the University of Vienna who has been working with these kind of particles for years. They bounced entangled particles off the moon a year or two ago. Mm. You know, they're doing amazing things. But the world doesn't know. And it's not because the world, it's not because it's barred from the world. The world is not being led to it. Nobody's trying to trying to stop people knowing about this. They're just not telling them, you know?
It is crazy because, you know, they say these particles that once they're observed, they cease, they're not there.
Yeah, that's what's hard to get my head around. I always have trouble with that one. It makes sense, but like, oh, it's a hard one, Anthony, that.
It's the idea that a subatomic particle is a, basically any subatomic particle before it is measured is in a superposition of states. It could be anywhere statistically, and it is in a statistical wave. It's a statistical wave function. When it is measured or observed, the particle literally has to choose to be somewhere physical, and it reduces down, and the wave function is collapsed to a point particle. But when it is not looked at, it is a wave. And this goes for everything. You know, it's not, people will turn around and say, well, these are subatomic particles. We're talking here about photons, tiny, tiny things. Photons don't have zero mass and travel at the speed of light. They're particles of electromagnetic energy. Well, not particles, they're the carriers of electromagnetic energy. Then you get, but they've worked recently to find that these weird effects were, when they're measured, come into existence. They found that it happens with electrons. They found it happens with atoms. And recently they've discovered it happens with molecules, big molecules. A buckyball has 60 atoms in it. It's a big molecule. They have done the experiments and done exactly the same thing. A buckyball is a wave until it is measured or observed, and then it becomes a point particle. Buckyballs are things, and atoms and molecules, the things that make up the reality all around us. The physical table that you're sitting next to, or the chair you're sitting on, they're all made of things that come in and out of existence on the act of observation. Now, that's deep. But that is where science is telling us it's happening.
Mm. So is that intelligence?
Well, that's the interesting. The big question is, how do we define an observer?
Yeah.
How do we define the act of observation? Can a cat be an observer? In which case, the famous Schrödinger's cat experiment falls on the table. We won't go into Schrödinger's cat now, but this Schrödinger's cat is one of the things you can use as an example of just how weird all this is. That is, you know, is consciousness prime? Is it consciousness that brings about the wave function? Or is it just an interface with anything in reality collapses the wave function? The big issue at the moment is, at what point does quantum physics turn into Newtonian physics? In other words, we have two completely different systems. We have cosmology, we have the world of big objects, and we have the world of subatomic particles. Even the maths doesn't work. If you use the equations for quantum physics and apply them to the big world, they don't work, and vice versa. So we have two different worlds, and one world is made up of the other, but they're totally different. Mm. And the argument is, at what size do objects become when quantum effects cease? And this is very important for the brain, because a guy called Stuart Hammerhoff and another guy called Roger Penrose, who's the Rouse Ball Professor of Mathematics at the University of Cambridge, bright cookie. Professor Hammerhoff is a professor of anesthesiology at the University of Arizona. Bright guys, they've come up with something called ORC-OR, which is basically that consciousness is created by quantum effects. Quantum effects in things called microtubules, which are very tiny structures, the structures that actually structures of tubulin that actually make the brain cells hold together. And each one of these little objects, and there's trillions of them in the brain, are creating micro holograms. Trillions of them. And I think that all these micro holograms that these little things are creating all the time is actually what we perceive outside. Reality is created by your brain using holographic techniques. And again, if you want to look it up, it's called orchestrated objective reduction. ORCOR.
It's like the Anthony the artist painting a picture of himself into eternity, you know? The artist painting a picture of himself painting a picture, and then he just keeps going, and he becomes the observer and the observed.
Well, very true. In fact, what you're suggesting there is something that was first suggested by a guy called J.W. Dunn. In 1928, J.W. Dunn wrote a book called An Experiment with Time, and that's one of the things he used. And, of course, it's an infinite regress. But effectively, and this is, again, one of these little-known facts that is not generally known by the public, if you take a holographic image, if you take a normal picture and you cut it up into parts like a jigsaw puzzle, each part is a little part of the whole. You know, it contains that bit of the picture. This doesn't happen with a holographic image. If you smash a holographic image and you have the bits of the holographic image, the whole image is contained in each bit of the image. Now, let that sink in for a second. That means that the part contains the whole. And if the universe is a hologram, that effectively means that everything is contained within everything else. So in your teardrop is the Andromeda Galaxy. And again, this is again not woo-woo science. This is very much the work of people like Professor David Bohm, who worked with Oppenheimer. You know, Bohm was, in fact, I call this illusionary reality the Bohmian IMAX, in deference to David Bohm. Everything is enfolded within itself. So therefore, you go into the deep and you will come into the very large. And this is why we see patterns. This is why we see patterns in things. The Mandelbrot set seems to go on forever and ever and ever. The music of Bach goes on forever and ever and ever. The mathematics of Kurt Gödel has the same things. These are patterns in nature.
Yeah,
the Fibonacci sequence. These all are showing that what we have is recursion. Everything rolls back on itself. And in my books, I write about this. I call it, well, I don't call it, but it's called the eternal recurrence or the eternal return. And I think this is what is happening to all of us. Everything is cyclical. We're actually a spiral.
Eternal recurrence. Yeah, I've been reading up on that. It's amazing, Anthony. I looked at a picture online someone put up, and it was just simply under heavy microscope. It was vitamin C inside rose hip. The rose hip, and it was just like this beautiful world. It's just amazing. I mean, it was just simple vitamin C inside the rose hip under magnification, and it was a whole nother world in there. And it just made me think, you know, there's just worlds within worlds within worlds. You just look at a flower or a grain of sand on the beach, and then you look inside a grain of sand, and there's all these patterns and other worlds, and then inside that more. It just makes you wonder what are we and what is life, you know?
Well, there you go. That's right. Going back in a beautiful circle back to William Blake, because one of the lines he said, to see heaven in a wildflower, to hold the universe in the palm of your hand. And this is exactly it. This is the magic of the wonderment of how the universe really works. You know, we have 1% of understanding of a universe that is infinitely more interesting than anything we can ever imagine. And this is what excites me. And this is why my ideas have never stayed in one place. I'm accused of changing my mind about things. Well, I change my mind because I get more information. And if that information conflicts with what I've written before, so be it. I'm not a believer in anything. I'm a seeker after truth. And if something conflicts or something disproves something I've written or something I've suggested, that's fine. That goes on the back burner. It's wrong. That's what science is, isn't it?
I've heard you say that, and I think that's wonderful. You know, I've heard you say if someone disproves something that you've said, you're fine to put that on the back burner and restart again. You know, there's no ego there. You're just learning like all of us, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think when you get people saying the science is settled on anything, it just makes me laugh because it isn't. It isn't settled on anything. I mean, we still know so little about the human brain, for example. You know, exactly. And how everything works. And for someone to say the science has settled on one thing alone, as I said, a grain of sand. You can't say the science has settled on one grain of sand on a beach somewhere on the Earth because it never will be, you know.
It's all hubris. It's all the idea that we know, we understand, we have got all the answers. No, we haven't. We're not even at the first stage of understanding. And I think future generations, if we survive the present situations, if we survive it, you know, future generations will look back and say, gee, what were they on? Where did they go with their science? You know, they were missing the obvious.
Mm.
You know, and I sometimes feel that this is the case, that there is this, and I sometimes touch upon it. You know, sometimes I'll think, I put these bits together and I feel I'm working with this huge jigsaw puzzle. And I know there's going to be a piece I'm going to put in, and it's all going to make sense. I may not do it, but somebody following on may do it. Now, that's not being vain, because I'm not into that. I really am not into that. I'm into getting ideas across to get other people to think. And this is what I do on my YouTube. This is what I'm doing on my Facebook page. I'm really generating ideas. People go away, think about these things, come back to me, talk to me. You know, I'm nobody special. You go away, you write your own books. This is what it's all about. It's all us trying to understand what we are and why we're here.
Exactly. Yeah, what's going on? And your Facebook's very open as well for people to dive in. Your books are amazing, Anthony. I've done a lot of research on afterlife experiences, and I read a lot of books. I just couldn't get it, but picking up your first book, Is There Life After Death, it's immediately strikes you, you know? Like in The Damon, you were talking about this falling out of time at the moment of death, which really struck me as well. It's quite amazing how our brain makes all these chemicals. I think glutamate was one, and we sort of just fall away from time. So I guess the observer who's watching someone's body die, because they don't really die, but they're sort of watching this person at the bedside die, that they don't really realize that person... Okay, they're sort of passing away, but I guess it's sort of like if you're standing on the shore and I'm talking to you, and then I get onto a little floating device and I push myself off the shore and I just sort of drift further away from you until you're out of sight. It's kind of, that's the way you explain it, that they're not quickly dying. They're sort of, every millisecond is becoming two and three, and they just sort of drift off into this death. And I'm sort of thinking, what happens in that moment when they're gone off like that? We just think, because we've been told to think, that, oh, that person's dead. But there's a whole nother process going on with the death experience that we're not understanding, and we're not giving people due respect. When they die, we're just shoveling them into a grave, Anthony. You know, you leave your work, you die, you're into a grave. But there's a whole experience there, like the grain of sand, that we're not understanding. And that's what's in your book. You sort of open all that up. And I find that, like Garth said at the start, we have to go back and keep reading parts of the book that you went over, and you're thinking, hang on, I've got to go back and read that again, because it's quite deep. But that really struck me a lot, how you explain that at the moment of death, where there's that stretching of time, you know, for a person. I think that's really well explained, and it makes a lot of sense to me as well.
Well, thank you. That's great. Right. Well, I'm aware that we're...
We're so, only got an hour with you, but I've got like 1,000 questions.
Well, maybe we can do it again. We can do it again, and maybe we could do something while I'm down in Australia. You know, absolutely. Maybe we could mix it up.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I've literally got thousands of questions, Garth, but it was good just to sort of introduce you today, Anthony, in case some people in Australia, for example, aren't familiar with your work, and they can get along to those talks for sure and get into your books and go on and order them from you. So we'll talk about that just before we go, your website and how people can get a hold of your books, because they're also on Kindle from the Amazon store as well.
Yep. No, you can get my books various ways. You can order them from bookshops. Some of them are in bookshops. Some of my latest books are available in bookshops. You can go to a bookshop and order them. You can go onto Amazon. They're available on Amazon. They're available in Kindle. I think they're in Mobo and various other e-books. You can also, if you're interested in actually having signed copies, you can order them directly off my website. Although you need to be aware that the postage costs to Australia sometimes are actually greater than the cost of the book, which I apologize for. There's not a great deal I can do about that. But effectively, my work is out there. In fact, I'll be writing an article for New Dawn, the Australian magazine,
at the end of this month.
I've written two articles for them. As you know, I've written a biography of Philip K. Dick as well. This article will be on my latest, the hypothesis coming forward in my latest book. So just check out, my website is anthonypeake.com. Also check me out on YouTube, also on Facebook, search me out as Anthony Peake. I have two sites on Facebook. One is Anthony Peake Writer and the other one is Anthony Peake. The Anthony Peake one is getting very close to its 5,000 limit, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to expand that at some stage. But please, guys, you know, you guys there and everybody out there, you know, get along to my talks. The only way that my ideas really come across is when I'm in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And it really is quite exciting, and I'm really looking forward to coming down. So get booked on those courses, because the quicker we can get booked, the quicker I can book my flights as well, because I've yet to book them, so I need to do that as well. Right. Okay, well, thanks, Adam, and thanks, Garth. Thank you very much.
Terrific.
Time. Much appreciated.
Great information.
Okay, then, guys.
Okay, stay safe.
And you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Garth.
Yes, mate.
There goes Anthony Peake, and a bit of a sledgehammer over the head.
Dear old me. Interesting.
Oh. Interesting. But, he's got a lot of work that he's done, a lot of books. So, because it's the first time we've had him on, it's good to just let him go through all that information. I think people can go to Cheating the Ferryman as well. Which is like a forum.
Yes.
And, join up there and put all your comments and stuff. So that's there for folks as well. But, as I said, I've got like a million questions. I've got so many questions, eh? Yeah. But, I held them back today just to let him go through all that sort of information, for folks out there. But it's really interesting. And, you know, when you compare this to the nightly news, Garth, and the Murdoch newspapers, and, you know, and what we get taught in schools and the general reality that's enforced on us around us every day, you know.
Yes.
You know, what they push and this bullshit, it's just astounding what we're missing out on and what we're not seeing.
Yes.
You know? We're not seeing around us, you know. It's really sad, as you said, that kids aren't taught this. They're just brainwashed in schools. And as we said a few weeks ago, what they're doing to kids in American schools is terrible. You know, it's really a disaster. And you hear a guy like Anthony talking, you just realize on how much you've missed out on.
Yep.
You know, and why couldn't I have done this earlier?
Yeah.
I wonder. I forgot to sort of ask Anthony. I wonder if he did, if he thinks that he did this in his last life. You know, and then he got to a point of research where your body expires and you come back. Do you have to do it again? Or is he continuing? You know, because some people, Garth, they just, they're born and from a very early age, they can just play piano. Like a lot of the great artists throughout time, they just do things, you know, and
they've done
it through lifetimes and they just know now and they've just mastered it. It's crazy. But there's so many questions that I wanted to ask him, but it was good just to get him on for that anyway, you know?
It certainly was, and it also makes, by talking to him, and I've spent about 2 or 3 hours over the last couple of days just listening to some of his stuff, and it sort of opens you up more to reading his books when you get in, because I find it's sometimes a lot easier listening to them and then reading.
Yeah.
Because it can get quite complex, particularly with this nanotechnology and the, you know. And, you know, there was one thing he was talking about was which I found, as you did, I had a lot of questions, but let him go because it's better that way. But he was talking about how at the speed of light, time ceases to exist, you know, and these quantum particles, because the photons travel at the speed of light, this is a part that tends to boggle the brain as well. But, you know, it's myself personally, I'm learning. I know a lot more today than what I did a month ago. And that's the important issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you sort of slowly get it up because these guys have been well educated, you know. And I was recently having a look at Tom Campbell's stuff too. I've got his book, which I'm about a third into, which is quite interesting too. So he does much the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's really some iffy stuff. Yeah, so if he sends you some links, post them on to me.
Yeah, I do often.
I think I've got some of the names. Marcus de Satu, but I'm not quite sure how he spelt it.
I'll put those up with this today. And there's a whole thing with the Gnostics even believe that man is trapped, like in the film The Matrix, that our bodies, our minds are trapped in an illusion. That the daemon that Anthony talks about is where we really reside, where we're meant to be, you know? We're constantly being reincarnated or whatever. I don't know. There's a whole lot of stuff there as well. You often wonder that, you know? Are we sort of trapped in an illusion, just going round and round and round? And what's it all about? What are we meant to learn? What is the daemon trying to teach us? You know, is there a way to get out of reincarnation? You know, it's a whole lot more.
Yeah, that's right.
In there.
You know, do you want to keep coming back?
No, I don't really want to keep doing my life over and again. One of my lives is enough. You know, I'm happy to do one life, but it's an interesting theory, and it does explain deja vu.
Yes.
Which I had a lot of when I was younger, and I had one not long ago, actually. I get them sporadically. Just little weird things. That I think it was getting something out of the back of the car. I just felt like I'd been here before.
Mm.
You know, I guess, you know, in your life, if you're just sort of born and you go through school and you work and you pay your taxes and you get married and you have a family and you go through the motions and you might have a desk job or whatever it is that you do. You know, see your friends on the weekend and you have a few grogs or whatever it is, you know, and you have a holiday here and there. You sort of ask yourself, am I just going through the motions? Have I done all this before? You know, am I just going along to get along? You know, is it a good idea to just radically change something right now? You know, just move to another country or go and do something that you've never done before, you know, to change it up.
Because
it could be about an infinite number of highways all around us, you know, millions of worlds, as Anthony talks about. But, you know, as he said, he could have been born in Tasmania if that had happened, you know. I mean, that could have gone a million different ways for all of us, you know. I mean, you know, my parents, you guys could have got divorced and I could have been born somewhere else. I mean,
that's
right. There's just millions of different ways that it could have happened.
Yes.
You know? And you sort of wonder in this life, you're just sort of going along, as I said, to get along, and you wonder, you know, is there something I'm missing out on? Have I done this before? It feels to me like I've done it all before, but I can't explain it or sort of put it into words. But with someone like Anthony doing this type of research, it gives us information to work with.
And access to
information that we didn't get in school, you know, because I did horrible in school. A lot of people do horrible in school because they just know fundamentally deep down that they're not meant to be there and that this is a wrong environment, but they don't know what to do because they're too young, so they lash out. And, you know, they get in trouble.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a human, we're not being given what we need, like a baby needs breast milk. you know, and we go into the schooling systems and we just get lost. And it's like we know deep down that we're meant to be learning something maybe, but we're not getting access to that information and we just seem to be being dumbed down all the time. And as Anthony said, yeah, they just, you know, you'd think, Garth, that, I mean, we spoke to Lloyd Pye, you know, a real scientist. I think Anthony Peake, these guys are real scientists on the edge there and they're pushing through the barriers of the norm, you know, and they're asking questions and they're coming up with these incredible, you know, information for people. But you wonder why these so-called scientists in the world, you know, and these people, these talking heads in our media and all these people around us, they don't want us to have this and they're not interested themselves. You wonder that. You think that they would hear this and they'd be so excited. You know, you think we'd be able to, you know, the schools would be overflowing with this sort of information. But they're dumbing us down. That's scary in itself because you think that whoever's controlling the system that we're living in knows the information, knows everything, and they're not only trying to hide all this information from us, but they're deliberately dumbing us down. As they keep it all for themselves. And it's, but, you know, as a human, you know, going through this life, Anthony talks about eudaimon, this higher dimensional self, this intuition, this guardian angel. As he said, we have different names for it. It's there. It's your passenger right through your life. And, you know, it's always talking to you if you just tune into it. But you get so... preoccupied with your bills and running your life and all these things, this circus going on around you.
When I came down to Sydney just recently, you know, at your place there, I got quite depressed. It hit me worse than it's ever hit me. You know, just being down there in that sort of environment, because I think, you know, I've been so spoiled. It's been a couple of years, I think, since I've been to Sydney, and it hit me like a brick wall.
Yeah, people are just plowing through, aren't they? Just charging through their life. It's like they want to get through their life as fast as they can.
Yeah, it's just a waste.
You just can't get in anyone's way. They get agitated and frustrated.
It's crazy, and that's it. Gave me, having not been down there for so long, I suppose, and having the luxury of living here, and you go down there, suddenly you're hit with it. It really hits you.
You do. You go to the country for a few days, especially where you are, with so much forest around, and you wake up every day with just nothing but the trees and the birds, you know, and. Gives you time to think and relax, but you get back into that urban city environment and it's so pushy and fast-paced. And as I said, yeah, people are locked into this technology and they just seem to want to rush through their lives, you know, as fast as they can, but along the way, strangely enough, not ask any questions, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Not ask about the world that's going on around them, this whole process, this whole order, you know? As we said, you know, looking at just a basic thing, looking at a blade of grass or a flower or a branch on a tree or a cloud or anything, you know, there's so much going on within that we just don't take notice of anymore. There's so much happening within life that we're missing out on.
Yeah.
Because we're not asking questions and people just don't seem to care anymore. And so preoccupied, and the television is doing all the thinking now for most people. It's, you know, it's taken the place of most people's brains. This plastic box on the walls of people's lives, just doing the thinking for people. And that's how they make their minds up. They come up with their information. And,
well, they want to live like they revere the... the people who are, you know, the stars or whoever, the big profile people, they want to frame their lives around them. But it's impossible. You can't do that. You know, that's why there's so many of these young girls, and particularly girls, end up on drugs because they want to become big time starlets, and they sort of prostitute themselves to think that they're going to get there by doing that, and they don't, because there's a lot more to it than just that. And it's a dreadful shame, because they're intelligent people, and you're seeing that a lot with them. It's a dreadful shame, because the material side isn't the answer. You know, and the more you get into this stuff, the more you realize that. It just, you know, when he was talking about these nanoparticles, like when you observe them, they virtually cease to exist. So it sort of explained to me, there was one book I read, I think it was called Biocentrism, and he was talking about that, but I couldn't quite understand what he was, like, right down to the nitty-gritty. I mean, they say if you turn away, if you're looking at something and you turn away, it's not there anymore. And I couldn't understand that, but when Anthony's explaining it in relation to the nanoparticle thing, it started to make sense. That when you're not looking at it, it's not there.
Yeah.
It's there, but when you're looking at it, I mean, it's sort of tied up with that. So I'm starting to get closer to it a little bit. It's very hard to put a handle on it. Isn't it? It's very hard, but I'm starting to feel that I'm getting a handle on it.
He says in the Daemon about cheating the Ferryman theory, it proposes that at the point of death, a cocktail of internally generated chemicals floods the brain, specifically a substance called glutamate. And in doing so, conscious awareness falls out of time. And so he says, as far as the subject is concerned, time slows down to such an extent that the subjective duration of each millisecond takes twice as long as the one previously. As such, we have an exponential increase, millisecond on millisecond, which very quickly has the dying person moving further and further away from the objective moment of their death. So as far as the observer is concerned, the person is seen to die, but when in the consciousness of the dying person, it's not like that at all. That sort of moment of death, as we see it, is never reached for them. That's what he's talking about in the book. So it's a really strange thing. He's saying that we kind of go into a recreation of the person's previous life. It starts again at the moment of birth. He calls it the Bohemian IMAX. So yeah, you can't tell the difference from the real thing. You just, you know, so this is strange, and I was sort of wondering, I wanted to ask Anthony about that, like, are we the same person in each life then? Because you hear about people reliving their past lives, that they say they were a soldier, or they were this or they were that. I saw a story from the UK where a little boy claimed that he remembered his past life as a black woman in New York, and she died in a fire. And now he's like a blonde little boy living in the UK. So I sort of wanted to ask about that. Like, are we the same person in each life? Exactly the same? Because I guess at that point of death, when we drift off, we go into this new life maybe. So it's a lot in it.
It seems we have a higher self, which is the daemon. That's the higher self. That's the...
your intuition, your guardian angel.
Yeah, so...
higher dimensional self, yeah.
So as all consciousness is combined, your present consciousness comes out in another body. That's how I see it. It comes out in another body, but it's that consciousness which is involved with its guardian angel or higher self or daemon, as Anthony calls.
Anthony's mentioned bad daemons as well.
I've got his book,
yeah,
Daemons, but I haven't read it yet. I'm still been struggling with his other one. So I must get into that as
there's
well.
There's a whole lot of, you know, there's DNA, Garth, you know, and we, you know, and what Lloyd Pye stated, that DNA could not have been started here on Earth. And it had to have been bought here as well.
And the DNA is intelligent.
It's intelligent, yeah, but Anthony's doing a lot of work on that as well, what's called our junk DNA. I mean, this is what they tell us in school. This is what our system tells us, that most of our DNA is junk. It's garbage. Just forget about it. Watch TV. Shut up. It's astonishing when it's the most important part.
So the bad daemons individually could be, could they be these Archons?
Yeah, I don't know if Anthony's into that, but...
No, I wasn't going to mention that either. I didn't.
You wonder about these Hollywood celebrities, you know, that live this life of excess, you know. They seem to know what they're doing, don't they? You know, like they become famous at a very young age and they just live this life of, you know, whatever it is, sex and alcohol and so much money and opulence that most people couldn't even dream of. And live these incredible lives, making these movies and living this whole dream world.
Well,
I wonder if they keep recycling because it's such a strong life that they had before, you know, and that they just keep living it over and over again.
Well, I have individually talked about that they've sort of given their souls to Satan. But the interesting side of that is that in the Bible, they talk about God or Jesus Christ or whatever was taken up to the mountain by Satan, and he was shown the world, and he said, you know, if you obey me, this is all yours. But I think it's basically symbolic, because if you do give your soul to Satan, you know, there are prizes to be got. But once you've given your soul, that's it. And maybe these people come back. And they come back as top artists and or wealthy people or whatever, because that's in One Light. I remember one of the other – it wasn't the One Light book, but it was the next book from there. I remember reading about that, how it said in that book that they return. But they return as the same – they didn't say Satan or anything like that, but they return as the same energy. Which is a bad energy. Quite crazy.
Yeah, if people want to look up the eternal return, it goes right throughout. Indigenous cultures, Egyptians, ancient Mayans and Aztecs, ancient Greece, goes right throughout. This sort of snake eating its own tail, dragon eating its own tail. Goodbye.